Hello, I'm Anthony D.P. Mann. Don't hold it against me. This is number 0562, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0562. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer, author of the new book, The Oppenheimer Alternative, a science fiction story that looks back instead of forward.
Oppenheimer famously said when the first atomic bomb went off 75 years ago at Alamogordo Trinity Test Site, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." He was quoting the Bhagavad Gita, a Hindu scripture. And what I wanted to contrive is a scenario where he and all the other scientists who had worked on that project could find some sort of redemption.
Actor Eric Palladino, one of the stars of the COVID-19-based quarantine drama Disconnected. It's a show that features actors from all over the world who shot their own segments while on lockdown.
I played Michael, and my character is a business owner. He has a restaurant, a successful restaurant in Los Angeles, California. And so at the front end of the show, he has to figure out how to navigate what he's been dealt and to continue to pay his employees. And he takes out a loan, or he tries to get a loan, and he puts his own money up in the beginning to continue to pay his employees, and he puts himself in a really bad spot.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0562, was Anthony D.P. Mann, who is an actor and filmmaker who does some amazing modern-day radio dramas. He's the founder of Bleak December Incorporated, a multimedia company, and you can check out their work at their website, bleakdecember.com. And thank you very, very much, Anthony, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Actually, before we get to the stuff, I just want to mention, regular listeners will know that over the last little while, we have had three guests who are involved in the digital soap opera Studio City. Now, star and creator Sean Kanan was one of them, along with two of his co-stars, Carolyn Hennessy, oh, the lovely Carolyn Hennessy, she's such a lovely lady, and Scott Turner Schofield. Now, all three of them have been nominated for Daytime Emmys this past week. In fact, the show received 8 nominations in total, including Best Digital Series, so congratulations to all involved and good luck in the upcoming awards. And The Big Night, by the way, will air live on CBS on June 26th. As the saying goes, check your local listings. Anyway, let's get to the stuff. You know, when you look around the world at the various government officials and how they're handling the COVID-19 crisis, you can't help but grade some of their performances. Now, I'm not going to name any names here, but some of them are doing a pretty shoddy job. Okay, I'll mention one name. A mayor in Peru's Tantara district laid in a coffin with a mask covering his face when cops in the small town came to bust him for breaking coronavirus lockdown rules. Jaime Rolando Urbina Torres was also drunk when police arrived. His drinking buddies took cover too when the cops came. The mayor had been dogged by criticism since Peru's lockdown began more than a month ago, actually 2 months ago. In addition to allegedly breaking quarantine rules personally, he is accused of leaving his town during the lockdown. Torres has also been criticized for being lax in implementing safety measures to contain the coronavirus pandemic in sparsely populated Tantara. At press time, more than 200,000 people have tested positive for coronavirus in Peru, and 3,000 have died. That's according to Johns Hopkins University. The South American nation has a population of 32 million people. Now, there's an actual picture of this guy wearing a mask while lying in a coffin. You'd think if he were dead, the mask would be irrelevant. Dead men don't tell tales. They also don't exhale. Meanwhile, a nurse in the western Russian city of Tula has been disciplined for non-compliance with the requirements for medical clothing after photos appeared on social media of her wearing only a bra and panties under transparent PPE on a COVID-19 men-only ward. The unnamed nurse told her superiors at the Tula Regional Clinical Hospital that wearing clothing under her PPE was too hot and that she didn't realize the protective gear was see-through. News reports stated that patients didn't seem to mind, though one admitted there was some embarrassment. Really? Embarrassment for who? Embarrassment would have been if she were not a Russian nurse from Tula, but instead a Russian nurse from Chernobyl. I understand their bras have three cups. And speaking of ladies' underthings, a serial underwear thief has admitted to breaching Singapore's strict coronavirus lockdown to sneak into a backyard and try to purloin women's lingerie. Lee Chi Kin has stolen underwear from homes on at least 30 occasions since 2018, and police found more than 100 bras during a raid at his home last year. The 39-year-old was on bail over previous charges of underwear theft last month, when he snuck out of home and climbed into a backyard on the hunt for more intimates. He was spotted by the homeowner and arrested. After the Singapore knicker's knicker got nicked, he admitted in court to breaking lockdown rules by leaving his residence without a good reason and failing to wear a mask outside, and also pleading guilty to charges of theft and criminal trespass. A prosecutor told the court that Lee would select bras and panties to steal based on their appearance. The accused used the stolen bras and panties for his own sexual gratification. Lee will also be sentenced at a later date and could face a jail term and hefty fine. So, he was stealing women's underwear for his own sexual gratification, yet he was also charged for not wearing a mask. You know, he really could have killed two birds with one stone here if he just thought this thing through. Yeah. Anyway, we have one more story to get to here in this edition of the Stuff File program before we get to our first guest. And that is, an unnamed ice cream shop in Hong Kong is offering tear gas-flavored ice cream in support of the region's pro-democracy movement. The shop's owner explained he wanted to make a flavor that reminds people that they still have to persist in the protest movement and don't lose their passion. "It tastes like tear gas," said customer Anita Wong. "It feels difficult to breathe at first, and it's really pungent and irritating. It makes me want to drink a lot of water immediately." The owner tried several different combinations to achieve the flavor and found that black pepper came the closest. Before coronavirus restrictions, he said the store was selling 20 to 30 scoops a day.
Ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream.
Not when it tastes like tear gas. Yes, we might scream, but not for the right reasons. Ugh. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer is one of the busiest guys on the planet. The Nebula and Hugo Award winner acknowledges the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb by taking us back to that time period, but with a twist. It's his latest book, entitled The Oppenheimer Alternative, Robert joins us via Skype from Toronto. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Peter. How you doing, my friend?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I said Oppenheimer. Some people say Oppenheimer.
He said Oppenheimer. He said Oppenheimer, and his nickname was Oppie. Everybody except his wife called him Oppie. His wife always insisted on calling him Robert.
Okay, so Oppenheimer it is. Now, I said in the introduction that you are a very, very busy guy, one of the busiest guys out there. If I'm not mistaken, this is like book number 26?
Well, that's right. It's I've got 24 novels and two short story collections, so 26. This is my 24th novel. A solid two dozen of them in a career as a novelist that now is 30 years on.
Now, as somebody who is a prolific writer, I'm assuming that, generally speaking, like a lot of writers, you are the kind of guy who does very well locked away. So what's it like now that the rest of the world is forced to quarantine in place? Is this just second nature for you, or do you also sometimes get a little stir crazy?
Well, here in Toronto today, it is a beautiful spring day, and those have been few and far between so far this year. So I'm feeling a little bit of an urge, you know, to be out walking around and getting some exercise. But in general, I have weathered this COVID-19 disaster, and it is a disaster economically and health-wise, quite well. My normal life, I work at home. My wife has worked for 20-odd years for me as my full-time salaried assistant for my little publishing venture here. It is not that much different. And it's been giving me an enormous opportunity to catch up on just pleasure reading as opposed to reading for research. So I want it to be over. My heart goes out to everybody who has lost somebody or is going to lose somebody, or is sick currently themselves, but it hasn't been a hardship for me personally.
As someone who writes science fiction, and by the way, I asked this question a little while ago when I spoke to another author, and that was talking to Dr. Dan Calla, who writes medical thrillers. I asked him a similar question. Since you are somebody who does science fiction, is what's going on right now within the realm of your consciousness as far as what you could possibly write, or is this beyond anything you would have written?
No, the sad truth is that this was so incredibly predictable. Science fiction writers have been writing about this notion of a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic, for many decades now. I popped in one of my favorite, I have it now on Blu-ray rather than DVD, films from 71 or 73, The Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston,
right,
which is a worldwide devastating plague that the government is way too slow in responding to. We've been warning the world for decades and decades about this. Go right back to my idol, H.G. Wells. Now, he was writing about deliberate release of deadly diseases. He has one of his short stories is called The Stolen Bacillus, meaning it's a bacteria, not a virus. But the notion goes back 125 years in science fiction. And what's astonishing is how ill-prepared our governments, who seem to have every contingency plan imaginable for military adventures, but completely unprepared for this inevitable crisis. It was absolutely inevitable, and it's not the last one we're going to face in our lifetimes, Peter, let alone likely this decade.
Wow. Well, let's get to your current book, The Oppenheimer Alternative. And as a writer, as a science fiction writer, you're usually spending time looking, if not in the near distant future, the greater future. But here you are actually going back in time to an historical event. Is that a little different from the type of thing you've done?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'm 24 books in, but I'm not like your typical mystery writer or a lot of science fiction writers who keep doing an ongoing series. I like to do something new every time. And the only reason at this stage in my career to write a new book is if I can think of a new challenge for myself. When I started writing, my first novel came out in 1990, I was doing far future science fiction. And I wasn't getting the audience that I wanted. I was getting hardcore science fiction readers. But I always felt that readers who don't habitually read science fiction would enjoy my stuff. So I moved it near future and found that a lot of people who would read Michael Crichton or Tom Clancy or Margaret Atwood would also very happily read a Rob Sawyer novel if it was set 20 years, maybe 30 at the outside in the future. And then I did a bunch of science fiction novels that were set in the present day. I thought, you know, maybe you can bring it right down to here and now. My most recent, Quantum Night, the one just before this, was set in 2016. That's the year it came out. But I thought, can you do it? Can you write a science fiction novel that has all those virtues of big ideas, speculative science, philosophical ruminations, and social commentary set in the actual past? Not a time travel novel, not going back to the Mesozoic to meet the dinosaurs, but, you know, in the 40s, the 50s, the 1960s. That was the challenge I set myself, and the Oppenheimer alternative is the answer to that challenge.
So tell us what the story is about. I mean, I understand it's about the atomic bomb, but you deal with actual people who lived in that time period that we know historically. So tell us what the story is about, and how difficult was it to write about real people in a fictional way?
Absolutely. So Oppenheimer famously said when the first atomic bomb went off 75 years ago at Alamogordo Trinity Test Site, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." He was quoting the Bhagavad Gita, a Hindu scripture. And what I wanted to contrive is a scenario where he and all the other scientists who had worked on that project could find some sort of redemption. None of them predicted the horrific situation we're in now, where North Korea has nuclear weapons and we don't know when they're going to go rogue, where we have a president in the United States who is talking about possibly using nuclear weapons again, you know, 75 years after the last time anybody ever used one. And I wanted to contrive a situation where there was a threat to the planet, where this same team of brilliant scientists, Oppenheimer, Albert Einstein, Enrico Fermi, Hans Bethe, could stay together and be able to say, maybe if they succeed, now we are become life, the saviors of the world. On every previous novel I've done, I have been the world's foremost expert on the characters, because I made them up. They came out of my head. And if a reader or a reviewer was to say, I don't think Caitlin or another character of mine would do that, I could say, you know, actually, yeah, she would. This is exactly why. I can tell you the psychology. I'm the expert. I know. On Oppenheimer, Einstein, Leo Szilard, Edward Teller, General Leslie R. Groves, the characters in this book, all of them have biographies written about them. Some have Pulitzer Prize-winning biographies. A few wrote their own autobiographies. I'm in no way, shape, or form the world's foremost expert, but I had to become expert enough that those who have devoted whole years and PhD theses and entire nonfiction books to these characters would say, yeah, Sawyer nailed them. And what pleases me is, for instance, Martin J. Sherwin, who won a Pulitzer Prize for the Oppenheimer biography, American Prometheus, gave a very positive blurb that's on the front cover of the novel.
Now, in doing your previous 25 books, you have to do a certain amount of research to get the science right for your science fiction. But here you have to do research into the past of people who actually existed. Was there a difference in the methodology of how you went about doing the research for this book as opposed to any others you've done?
Absolutely, because the only people you can really research potential and future science with are scientists. Whereas when you're researching the past, you can find the accounts of cab drivers and short order cooks and nurses and doctors and lawyers and clergy people and so forth. There's so many more perspectives to be absorbed on the past. So many people have their recollections. It's still in the living memory. Remember, it's 75 years ago for the atomic bomb, and the novel ends in 1967. So it's in the very much in the lifespan of a lot of living people. You have all that history, all that lived human history to draw upon. I felt, you know, usually I feel a little bit like a science popularizer, like somebody like a Neil deGrasse Tyson when I'm writing one of my science fiction novels. And in this case, I felt a lot more like Ken Burns, the documentarian, who, if you remember his Civil War series for PBS, there were all these letters from otherwise completely forgotten soldiers to their left behind girlfriends or family or little sister or whatever back home on both sides of that horrible, horrible war. We have all those little memories and it would keep popping up with a little recollection from Mary Chestnut or somebody. That kind of lived history was such an invigorating bath to immerse myself in. I loved doing it.
We are talking with science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. His latest book is called The Oppenheimer Alternative. And we'll continue talking with Robert here on the Stuff File program after a quick break. Don't go away.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And the Stuff File program is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. And we continue our conversation with science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. As I mentioned, a very busy guy. His 26th book is now out. It's called The Oppenheimer Alternative, and it goes back to a time period when the atomic bomb was dropped and deals with real-life people from that era. And Robert, when you were doing the research for this book, unlike others, again, where you're just looking for information to write your stories, you were going back in history. So was there anything that you learned during your research that was a surprise to you?
This was astonishing. My jaw was on the floor. I had no idea, because it simply hasn't been widely reported, that for a year prior to the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, Japan had been making back-channel overtures to surrender to the Allies. They knew the war was lost. They knew they were defeated. All they wanted one condition, which was that Hirohito, the divine emperor, and they considered their emperor to be a divinity, be able to retain his throne after resignation. And in a ridiculous, one of those moments that history turns on that's just horrible because it was unplanned, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in a press conference, after consulting with Churchill, they'd agreed, as the two great leaders of the two Allied powers at that time, they'd agreed that they would accept surrender from Japan. But in a press conference that was televised, FDR went off script and said, unconditional surrender. And Churchill was taken aback. No, they can have their emperor. No, they got to have a government, right? We can't have anarchy on those home islands after the war. There has to be a functioning government post-war. That's the way these things work. But once FDR had said it, Winston Spencer Churchill had no choice but to say, I got to back him up. We can't be seen to be anything less than in solidarity. And so it became this ridiculous demand that Hirohito not give up, that Hirohito give up the throne, the Japanese refusing. And in the end, of course, Hirohito was emperor for decades afterwards. We ultimately gave Japan the one condition they had demanded. We gave it to them immediately. Of course, you get to keep your emperor. And the war could have ended without the bomb ever being used. Those deaths in Japan, those horrible, horrible deaths that we commemorate every year on August 6th for the bombing of Hiroshima, and August 9th for the bombing of Nagasaki, the only time atomic or nuclear weapons have ever been used deliberately against human beings, could have been avoided because of a slip of a tongue by FDR.
Or actually, Truman, right?
No, it was FDR who made the mistake.
Yes.
And then Truman agreed to follow through.
Okay. Okay.
Truman, you're absolutely right. Truman was president at the time of surrender, but FDR was the one who blew it on the press conference. Now, I don't know what I was thinking, he said. I just, you know, you're there, there are the lights, the camera's rolling, you're trying to be chatty, and you do this too, Peter, I'm sure, as a broadcaster. You only sort of semi-follow the script. You sometimes look at, oops, I said unconditional. Well, I guess that's the new ballgame. But you're absolutely right. It was Truman they surrendered to. Truman was not anywhere near, I don't think, history will judge presidents as they will. But I think FDR was way more of a statesman than Truman was. Truman did not even know about the Manhattan Project until after he was vice president. Until after FDR died. It wasn't until he was sworn in as president that he was even brought into the loop on the development of the atomic weapons.
Well, you mentioned presidents not following a script. I think we are living through that time now, which brings me to my next question, and that is, a lot of times when science fiction writers, again, talk about the future and talk about what could happen, they're really talking about what is happening now and perhaps preventing what could happen in the future, or an allegory to what our current times are. Does it work the same way when you are writing a science fiction novel that looks back at the past? Are we talking, or are you talking about something that is currently going on?
Yes. In fact, I mentioned that this is an alternate history that keeps the Manhattan Project scientists together to avert climate change disaster, to save us from an environmental catastrophe. So absolutely, what we have avoided having is a kind of our Manhattan Project or our Apollo moonshot of dealing with climate change. At no point has any government in Canada, the United States, anywhere in the world said, whatever it takes, blank check, just solve this damn thing, right? It hasn't been said yet about climate change. And so really this is kind of, in its own way, a reflection on the fact that when we were faced in the past with what seemed insurmountable problems, get a human being on another world, harness the very fundamental nature of reality and the power of the atom, we did it just by essentially writing a check for whatever needed to be written. Even now in COVID-19, our governments are basically saying, okay, here's money, here's stimulus. We'll account for it later. Don't worry about it. But on climate change, for whatever reason, we still continue to say, well, I don't know if we can afford to do carbon trading or caps or switch to clean energy. And I guess that's very much the real world message behind this novel, is money can flow into a problem. If it flows enough, we'll solve that problem.
One of the things that's very popular these days on television, especially on cable television, are shows that deal with an alternative history. It sounds like this book, and I know in the past you have done books that have been turned into films or television shows, it sounds like this book is screaming to be a cable network series. Are you looking forward to that possibility?
I 100% am. I was supposed to be in Los Angeles last month, pounding the pavement, going around to the Hollywood studios. You mentioned I had a TV show, Flash Forward, adapting my novel of the same name on ABC, starred Joseph Fiennes and John Cho. It's still fondly remembered among studios in Hollywood. I get any meeting I want at Netflix or at Amazon or the four big networks or sci-fi, you name it. And I was supposed to be there last month presenting the Oppenheimer alternative. Well, here I am at home talking to you by Skype because we're not allowed to fly. I just had an inquiry from a guy in Hollywood about the film rights, and we're certainly hoping that somebody's going to pick it up, because absolutely, I do think it is made for the screen, 100%.
And full disclosure, Flash Forward is my favorite Robert J. Sawyer book, and the thing that is interesting about it is I enjoyed the television show, but I read your book after the show was on the air. And I found, as much as I enjoyed the television show, I really enjoyed your book.
Well, I like to hear that. It's always nice to hear the book is better than the TV show or the movie. And it was a good TV show.
Yes, it was.
But this was, you know, more than anything, more than the nice pile of money that ABC gave me for the show. It's the publicity of people like yourself finding an author. Oh, that's based on a novel by. I'll go look up that guy. And it was the biggest single boost in the size of my reading audience that I've ever had was because of that show. I'm very, very grateful to it.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your wife works with you. And one of the things I've always marveled at from the first time I've spoken to you, and we've talked a lot on this show and on my previous radio show as well, is how in tuned you are with social media. And one of the things that is sort of the enemy of writers is that you often have individuals who are, for better or worse, kind of hermit-like, and they work very hard on the production of their book, but really don't like to do the other half of the just as important job, of promoting the book. And you've been very good on social media literally since day one. Was this something that was an aha moment to you, or was something you realized early on, this is what I have to do?
Oh, the latter for sure. My first novel came out in 1990. The only way for a reader to reach a writer that way back then would be to send a paper mail letter to the publisher. So my publisher back then was Hachette, Warner Books. And once or twice a year, some intern or somebody in the office would get around to taking the three or four paper mail letters that had come in and been addressed to me and put them all in a bigger envelope and send them on. And eventually, so months later, I would write a little response to whoever had written to me. In 1995, 5 years into my publishing career, the World Wide Web became essentially a publicly available commodity. And I realized immediately that I could disintermediate, could take the publisher out of the loop between me and my readers. I still wanted a publisher to produce my books, but I wanted to have that direct contact. And I was the first science fiction writer in the world to have a website, sfwriter.com, SF like in science fiction. And using that, and as they developed all the subsequent things, blogging and Twitter and Facebook and all the other ways that we interact now with our readers, Patreon, I have a Patreon account, is wonderful. It is so much more interactive, so much more of a feedback mechanism. On my Patreon page, people were reading chapters of the Oppenheimer alternative as I was writing them and giving me feedback, which is an extraordinarily valuable thing for an author. So yeah, absolutely. We live in an age now where the author in a garret, hidden away from public view, still exists, but they only exist because they choose to exist that way. And I think it's very much to their detriment and to the detriment of their readers.
Does the feedback from readers while you're writing actually help? Because I can also see how that might hinder some people.
Oh, you've got to know, what to listen, what resonates with you and what doesn't. The more feedback, the better, as long as you yourself are not just blown like a leaf in the wind, right? Somebody will say more action. You put that in. Somebody will say, no, no, more character. You change it back. But you can't do that. But one of the pieces of feedback I got about halfway through this book, a friend of mine said to me, you know, this is really, besides everything else, this is a love story, but it's buried. And I thought, my God, she's right. It is a love story between Robert Oppenheimer and a woman named Jean Tatlock, who was the love of his life. And I foregrounded that. It's in the opening chapter. It's in the final chapter, and strengthened it as kind of the spine of the book. And for whatever reason, I had just, you know, sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. I had just been too close to the project to see that that element was seeded in there, but that it really needed an opportunity to continue the horticultural metaphor to blossom.
I know it's kind of ironic to ask a science fiction writer to look into the future of his own life, but with all that's going on right now and what we are dealing with in this pandemic, do you think that this will somehow affect your future writing?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody has to grapple with this, reality. And what it's done is it, you know, my friend William Gibson famously said, 30 years ago, the future is already here. It's just not widely distributed yet. What's happened is suddenly everybody realizes they're living in the Jetsons universe of video conferencing, video calls, of avatars, of telepresence and telecommuting and automation and robots. People could have been kind of blissfully, you know, oh yeah, my teenage son or my teenage daughter is into that, but not have any engagement with them themselves. This has forced everybody from, you know, great-grandparents on down the chain of life to engage with the fact that we live in a science fictional world. We live in a world where we mediate our interactions through computers, and it has primed the pump for the general public to be ready for much bigger science fictional ideas than the kind of simple, worn out ones that they normally get in the mainstream version of science fiction. I think it's really upped everybody's game. Everybody now is a futurist.
And the latest book, which actually goes back to the past, is The Oppenheimer Alternative. It's also available as an ebook. It's available right now. People can get their hands on it and start reading it lickety-split.
Ebook, print book, and audiobook. Audiobook doesn't drop until June 2nd. But yes, all the formats you might enjoy, we're having the property out there in every way that people might like to experience it. I myself tend to be an ebook reader, but I love to have paper books and audio. I was an early adopter of audiobooks. It's there in whatever form you want to have it. The Oppenheimer Alternative is there for you to get.
And I have to say thank you to you, because you were one of the very first guests on the Stuff File program when I started this show now 11 years ago. At a time when I really didn't have an audience, didn't know if I was going to have an audience, I gave you a call for a book that you had out at that time. And again, I could call you anytime and you have a book coming out at that time because you're just so prolific. But you came on the program. You were a great guest then. You're always a great guest. And I really appreciate you stepping forward and being a guest on the show and in the earliest stages of it. So thank you for that.
Oh, an absolute pleasure, Peter. You know, when CJAD let you go in Montreal, that was a ridiculous mistake on their part, I have to say. You were one of the great voices of Canadian radio. And when you said, you know, I'm relaunching in a new platform, a new format, I wanted to be there for you 100%. And I'm so glad that the Stuff File is, you know, I happen to know 561 programs now. This is just spectacular.
Again, thank you very much for being on the program, sir.
My pleasure.
Science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. His latest novel is The Oppenheimer Alternative. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0562, and you'll find links to Robert's site and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do have an idiot of the day coming up on the program a little later on, but we're not going to do more Stuff File news here. We spoke for such a long time to Robert J. Sawyer that we have to cut some things here. So we're not going to do more Stuff File news, and I do want to get to our next guest, who is another special guest. And someone I'm a big, big fan of. We'll get to that in just a second. I do have to mention, of course, that this program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also on Spotify. So let's get right to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? You know, it didn't take long for a scripted show to come along that deals directly with the trying times we live in. A new COVID-19 web series called Disconnected premiered on May the 5th on YouTube. One of the stars of the show is Eric Palladino, whom you may remember from shows like ER, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Suits, and NCIS Los Angeles, just to name a few. Eric joins us via Skype from Los Angeles. Hi, Eric.
How you doing, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. By the way, longtime fan, enjoyed your work, and I was just wondering, this show is so unique in that it takes actors from literally around the world, different parts of the globe, and puts them together in this show that has to be really shot, not necessarily with a crew, but with a skeleton situation involving the actors themselves. How did you come to this particular project?
Matt Lutwiler, the co-creator, and I have been friends for 25 years. Actually, the first film I had ever starred in the mid-90s, a little indie called Roadkill, Matt wrote and directed. The history is long. You know, I wound up coming to it now, but, you know, we have a long friendship for over 25 years, and we actually co-created a show that we shot in Rwanda last year, me and myself, Matt Lutwiler, and another actor, Vince Ventresca, who's also in this show as well. And we all met on a film that Matt directed after that first film I did called The Space Between Us. And, you know, and then we became friends since then. Matt has a tendency to cast and work with the same, you know, kind of group of people. You know, he changes, like, you know, sometimes with fellow producers, fellow co-writers. But on the acting end, you know, he likes to use a lot of the same actors. It's almost like a theater group. And so we're, you know, there's a familiarity between us. You know, that usually, you know, kind of pops on screen. In this situation, you know, we're not really working together because it's all, you know, different storylines. And a lot of the actors that he's used are people that he was friends with, not necessarily people that I knew and had a history with, but people that he had worked with before, and some people that aren't actors in any way, including my wife, Jamie Palladino, who's actually wonderful on the show. And I joke around with her constantly. I'm like, I can't believe how good you are at this this thing that I've dedicated my whole life to. You just started doing 2 days ago and you're as good as me. You know, so when he first approached me with it and told me what the story would be, you know, and it, you know, they had a loose kind of outline idea of what it was going to be. I just didn't think it would be possible to, you know, I was skeptical that it wouldn't, you know, be possible, because how do you make a show and turn it around, get a script and turn it around within 7 days and then put it out there? An episode of NCIS LA takes 3 weeks, and that's 3 weeks from camera starting to shoot to editing and color corrected and then delivered. That doesn't mean writing as well, you know what I mean? But with theirs, it's like they write the script in 3 days, deliver it, and then in 7 days, the actors shoot it themselves with no crew, not even a skeleton crew. You know what I mean? A skeleton crew implies that there might be a cameraman or a, you know, a sound guy, or, you know what I mean, or a director on set. There's nothing on set. So every scene you see with every actor is, you know, shot by the actors. And so you're basically running sound, you know, turning the camera on, and then jumping in front of the camera and acting, and then cutting, and then shutting the camera off, shutting the sound off, writing the new take on the clapboard. Not a clapboard in this scenario. We don't have a clapboard. We use our hands to do the clap. You know, with them on the phone, so Matt and Anton Lanes, the other co-creator of the show, who's been wonderful. The funny thing is, Anton has directed most of my scenes. I don't know how it worked out that way, but, you know, and Matt is, you know, off directing a scene and, you know, writing and producing. So, I mean, they're doing so many things while they're directing you in a scene. So Anton's would be directing me in a scene on Zoom call, right, while we're acting in it. But at the same time he's directing me in a scene, he's also on another Zoom call or a phone call with Matt. So there's so many things going on that I can't believe when I saw the first finished product of the first episode. You know, I went into it thinking that it was going to really look like a low budget independent film. And when I saw the first episode, I couldn't believe the level of the production value. You know, that's a huge part of movies. When someone asks me to do an independent film, I ask them what the budget is, not because I want to know how much I'm going to make or how much, you know, the money they got, or, you know, I usually think, you know, if they have a very little amount of money, the production value is what suffers the most. In other words, it just looks like a, you know, a student film, you know what I mean? When they don't have enough people, you know, making the set design look good, you know, the camera crew, the lighting, they need lights to make it. But nowadays, I guess looking at this, there's so much they could do in post and with these cameras that it's possible to make these shows in a much different way than how it ever was done previously. And Matt and Anton, to their credit, are just hitting it out of the park.
On a usual set, there is a certain amount of camaraderie, you know, from craft services to rehearsal times to shooting scenes to talking with the crew, not just the other actors. But you don't get to do any of that beyond your own family because everybody is so remote. When you finally saw the finished product and you saw the other actors who are literally in other parts of the world, was there a yearning to at some point say, you know, at some point when this is all done, we've all got to get together?
Yeah, that's a great question, man. It's funny that you brought that up because we haven't talked about that like with each other yet. But, you know, I absolutely thought that a couple of times. I went, wow, that's so weird. We're in such a different space, and you know, obviously, you know, on every level, you know, and different worlds we're essentially living in, but also connected through this experience. Hence, you know, why it's such a, you know, a relatable idea, because we're all going through this together, everyone throughout the world, and the idea is bigger than us, which is what the coronavirus is. It's sort of bigger than us. And so I have had a yearning, you know, to connect with the other cast members and to, you know, have a drink with them so you could talk about, like, hey, how's your shoot going and what's going on here and what's going on? And since we've started, because that first episode had a Zoom call in it with all of us pretty much, there was maybe one or two people that weren't on the Zoom call. And that was our first time we had all seen each other, about 10 minutes before we shot that scene. And we haven't seen each other since we've started. So there's been a couple of times throughout while we were shooting, I said, oh, it'd be nice to have a scene with this person, or you know, just go out for drinks afterwards. But we really don't know anything about each other other than like Vince Ventresca and I are very good friends. And Mark Kelly as well, who's a wonderful actor. Mark Kelly is part of that initial Matt Lutwiler connection from back in the day.
You know, we've spent so much time talking about the process that we haven't had time to deal into your actual character and what your character is going through. Now, basically, the plot of this show is various people from around the world are dealing in their own way with COVID-19. Who do you play and what is your character going through?
I play Michael, and my character is a business owner. He has a restaurant, a successful restaurant in Los Angeles, California, and obviously, when the shutdown happens, his business income is no longer there, and he still has rent to pay, and he still has a tremendous amount of responsibility towards his employees. It's a fairly substantial restaurant with a decent amount of employees. And so at the front end of the show, he has to figure out how to navigate what he's been dealt and to continue to pay his employees during this time, because restaurant workers are, you know, really the sect of, you know, the world that's, you know, getting really struck hard during this time. So he feels a tremendous amount of responsibility to, you know, keep these guys and the girls, his employees going. And he takes out a loan, he tries to get a loan. And he puts his own money up in the beginning to continue to pay his employees. And he puts himself in a really bad spot. Mm. And so really it's about him navigating through that. That's kind of my storyline. I think it's a very relatable one, too. It's interesting how many friends of mine have watched it that have businesses that say how uncomfortable it is watching me.
how when all is said and done and we get through the other side of whatever we're going through right now, how do you think what you've learned as an actor through this whole process and what the other actors and the crew have learned throughout this process is going to change how you work in the future whenever the new normal comes around?
I mean, I'm not sure Hollywood necessarily itself has the film industry itself has figured out what they're going to do this next year and a half. I think it's in process, and I don't think they have a plan yet. There's some people that have sort of a plan. Tyler Perry, he has his studio in Atlanta, and I think that he's, you know, going to sequester actors and everyone and your crew and try to do it that way. And that might work for him, because it's sort of a compound, his studio, but I don't know where else it's going to work. I'm not sure how I'm going to go back to work. My wife and I both have pre-existing conditions, and I'm not sure I could step on a set in 3-4 months and just, you know, hopefully, you know, not get, you know, the virus. I don't know what we're going to do. On a personal note, as far as how shows get made, I've always had a little bit of a, you know, a spirit of, you know, thinking a little bit, you know, towards, you know, making something in an independent way. And that's why I've always loved working with Matt, because it's us versus them a little bit, the little guy, you know, and trying to, you know, make his own path. And what I've learned is that maybe I could do it a little bit more on my own too. I've been writing now for, you know, the last 10 years and trying to get stuff going on that level, but now I'm like, oh, well, maybe I could make stuff just on my own. And maybe I could make stuff on my own in the house. You know, maybe I could make stuff on my own with just 3 or 4 actor friends that I know are, you know, really careful and aren't, you know, going out and putting themselves in situations that, you know, could be, you know, compromise their health. I think that doing this has given me the confidence to possibly do more of it.
One last question. We've got just less than a minute, and that is, I know you've also been in several bands. Will you get the opportunity to ever do that kind of thing again?
You know, I mean, I stopped playing in live band situations, you know, about 6-7 years ago, but I don't know. I mean, I had tickets to the Hollywood Bowl coming up, and to see a Canadian, Alanis Morissette. They canceled that show, and it's outdoors, and I don't know when that's going to happen again. I have no idea. I think that it would have to happen in very small venues. People are going to have to, at least for the next year and a half, approach things outside the box and start doing things differently than they ever have before.
Well, speaking of outside of the box, you guys have really hit it out of the park, to mix another analogy, with Disconnected, which is available on YouTube. Eric, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. And above all, you and your family, stay safe.
You too, Peter. Thank you very much for having me.
Actor Eric Palladino. You can see him right now in the groundbreaking series on YouTube called Disconnected. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0562, and you'll find the YouTube links to the show. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for, boys and girls, yes, that moment you've all been waiting for, the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
In the UK, a 20-year-old rookie cop has been banned from the job for life after stealing 7 breakfasts from the canteen in his first week. PC Jamie Larman helped himself despite knowing he was meant to pay for the grub. Trainees whose homes are more than 20 miles away could stay on site and get free meals, but he lived nearer to the training center. He was caught when another Thames Valley police officer heard him say, "I'm not entitled to this, but I should be. I only live just inside the boundary." Larman later claimed that he had nicked the food to build rapport with colleagues. He is now banned from applying for a job in any police force in Britain ever again. Larman was a police community support officer before starting his new role as a constable in January, but he quit after he was challenged about stealing the breakfasts. He had also been warned last year when he was caught nicking food before a training day. Chief Constable John Campbell told the hearing, he states his actions were to build rapport with colleagues who met early for breakfast ahead of training. I consider this nonsense. Well, I couldn't say it better myself. I mean, why? Oh, why? When you're training to be a police officer, would you knowingly steal 7 breakfasts in 1 week and then brag about it? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0562. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0562. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.